Welcome to TNT's Will podcast, the official companion podcast of the TNT series Will. Each week we'll have an in-depth discussion about the latest episode of the show with its creators. I'm your host, Michael Wood. I'm the author of a biography of Shakespeare and films about Shakespeare's life. I'm a historian, and I'm specially interested in the connection of Shakespeare to his life and times, and some of the characters in the series: the Jesuit priest Robert Southwell, the torturer Richard Topcliffe, are people who specially got me going when I wrote about this, so I'm really looking forward to this. I'm going to introduce you to our guests. Craig Pearce, the creator and executive producer of Will, whose work is known all over the world. Romeo and Juliet with Leonardo DiCaprio, who can forget that? Moulin Rouge, The Great Gatsby. And Shekhar Kapoor, the executive producer and director, whose films include Elizabeth the Golden Age. So, great to have you both here.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's so great to be here. It's fantastic.
It seems to me, and it's scintillating to watch, let me say, fantastic.
Thank you.
Really
thank
great you. Job. Scintillating. Wonderful energy.
Thank you.
Three big themes came out for me in the first episodes. Politics and art, stroke poetry, and life. So can we turn to the politics first? I mean, a lot of people think of the Elizabethan age as being golden age, you know, good Queen Bess and all that. What you paint is a time of fantastic dynamism, but real danger and police state. Tell us what led you to that.
Well, research, really, because, you know, that really was what it was like. But of course, when you make a drama, you're not making a documentary, so you're making choices and you're pulling out and emphasizing what you want to emphasize. And, you know, we didn't want to make a museum piece. We wanted to speak about today through the past. So, you know, one of the things I did when I was researching and writing was look at the parallels between then and now. And then it was a time divided by fundamentalism. People were willing to die for which brand of God they believed in, like today. And it created a climate of fear. England was surrounded by very powerful Catholic states. It was Protestant. And Catholicism was outlawed. And if you were found to support Catholicism, if you were a priest, you were hung until you were nearly dead, cut down, your stomach was slit open, your guts were taken out and shown to you as you were, you know, in agony and thrown onto the fire, and your heart was plucked out, and by then, fairly much, you were probably dead, and your body was chopped into quarters, and the quarters were, you know, displayed. Sometimes they were taken to the four corners of the kingdom as warning of what happens if you transgress and defy the state. So this was all real and true, and for a drama, it's a great bed in which to set a world, especially when you're saying that your lead character, William Shakespeare, is distantly related to the most wanted man in England, Robert Southwell, who's head of the underground Catholic movement.
A Scarlet Pimpernel almost, isn't he?
That's, you know, right.
And actually, Shakespeare's mother's, the head of Shakespeare's mother's family is hanged, drawn and quartered when Shakespeare's, you know, in the early 1580s, Shakespeare's in his late teens.
Yeah.
So the terror of the state actually touches him directly, doesn't it, Shaker?
Yeah. I'd done Elizabeth as a film, so I was pretty familiar with the politics of that time, Shakespeare's time. And I remember very well somebody saying, Elizabeth is a really melodramatic film, as I was making it. And I said, well, you know, you cannot judge Britain by the Victorian times when all the melodrama was hidden under long skirts, you know. There were very melodramatic times. People died young. Death was always around the corner. And as Craig says, you know, the Inquisition was a time of the Inquisition in Spain. And it was threatening, constantly threatening to come into Britain. And ultimately, it was very complex also, this whole conflict between Catholicism and being Protestant, because Elizabeth was, in fact, at that time, trying to replace the idea of the Virgin Mary, which she had said, okay, let's get rid of Catholicism. But what she was trying to do is say, I am the Virgin Mary now. That was the whole idea behind the virginity of Elizabeth. So it was very complex. And so you didn't quite know when the complexity would hit you and you would suddenly be denounced as a Catholic. Sometimes you were Catholic. Sometimes it was just a feud. Sometimes somebody didn't like you. Sometimes you were being favored with a piece of land and you would be denounced as a Catholic. So they were very melodramatic and very troublesome times.
Yeah. Mm. I think also you've got to always imagine when you look at Elizabeth's time that England had been a Catholic country, a traditional mm-hmm. Christian, let's call it that, you know, for a thousand years almost, you know, and the ordinary people. Faced with a government that had gone from Catholic under Henry to being half and half. He'd gone hardline Protestant under Edward, come back to being hardline Catholic, gone back to being Protestant under Elizabeth. So the ordinary people are being forced to, you know, adapt themselves to what the government was doing and not being quite sure where the future was going to lead. And Shakespeare, in a sense, being born in 1564, he's right on the cusp, isn't he? I mean, most people probably still inside are sympathetic to the old religion, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And I think what's very interesting and that we can't forget is that at that time, it wasn't just Protestant versus Catholic. There was extreme versions of Protestantism. As represented by the puritanical side of the rise of Puritanism. And of course, they ended up, you know, they hated the theatres, they hated popular entertainment, they hated a lot of things, they hated mirrors and dancing and music. And, you know, they were not dissimilar in some ways to the Taliban in their beliefs. And they eventually won under Cromwell, and they did pull the theatres down. And this is where you start to see the rise of it. And, you know, the railing against the type of art that Shakespeare and his company are producing, it's a very real threat because actually it happened under Cromwell.
That brings us very nicely to our second big theme, if you like, in the opening shows, which is art. And the theatre is the main form of public discourse, isn't it? That's what makes this so exciting. Yeah. Once you're a playwright and there's 3,000 people coming to every show in the Globe or the theatre, you have an amazing position of power and influence, potentially, don't you?
Yeah. It was the birth of popular entertainment as we know it. There was no theatre in London, probably the Western world, since Roman times. And this guy who was a carpenter, James Burbage, said, I'm going to build this 3,000-seat sort of auditorium thing and charge people money to go and see plays. And everyone was like, you're crazy. That's never going to work. But, of course, it did, and competition sprang up. And so there was this very new, very vibrant form of popular entertainment. And we always thought, and it was like rock and roll. You know, 3,000 people crammed into these wooden structures. And if they loved it, they'd cheer you to the heavens. They were very passionate about it. If they hated it, they'd burn the place down. And they were doing 6 shows a week and, you know, a new play every couple of days in the theatre company. So this very modern, very voracious, very violent kind of passionate energy. And so that's what, you know, that's the kind of theatre that we created, and we went, okay, well, that's the energy of our show and of our lead characters.
I think you portray that fabulously, actually. I think that sense of a high-pressure, fast-turnover, competitive industry, really competitive. I love the feel of all that in the shows.
I think there's an inherent rebellion in me that I rebel against it. So I think if I was born at the time, I would have been an active participant in that theatre, and I would have been there in the mosh pit screaming and shouting. That's my nature, but also remember that art at that time was usurped. Art itself was usurped by the nobility. It was not considered something for the people of the streets and the people that lived in the streets. If you say their art, they say, well, they're not capable of art. And that's one thing that Shakespeare did. And then my question to Greg always was, and I'll forgive my word there, I won't use it, but it was a different word. It was like, when the hell did the intellectuals and nobility usurp Shakespeare? Because Shakespeare brought art down to the streets. And that's when I got interested, when Craig sat down and we talked about it. And when I realized that actually he gave it, he was a rapper, he was a street rapper. He would have been in Bronx at this time, rapping on the streets. And so he gave something, a form of art to the people of the streets. And that was a significant contribution. Just talks about a world that after Shakespeare, even today, when I went to university, nobody told me that. Suddenly Shakespeare became an intellectual pursuit.
Right.
And that's what I rebelled against. I always rebel against history because I think that you know, I don't want to be consigned to a mantelpiece 600 years from now and say that's how I lived. I'm a living, breathing, acting, rebellious human being. And they were living, breathing, active, rebellious individuals. And we consigned them to a mass. So part of the energy of that is a rebellion against what they did to Shakespeare. And I wanted to go out and say, guys, let's put you there. Let's put you in the theater. Let's put you as part of the participant of the theater, as a participant of the crowd, and make you feel what it was like.
Easy to forget, isn't it, how subversive some of this stuff was. You know, there's a censor. Their plays are stopped from being performed or taken off.
People are thrown into prison.
Yeah, you can see
tortured.
How, I mean, Topcliffe, the torturer in your shows, encounters the players. You know, he's actually brought in on one of those cases where they're questioning whether a show is subversive. You can see, you know, how dangerous that could be. I mean, Richard II, when the king is deposed, that scene wasn't allowed to be printed until after Elizabeth's death. And you've got a famous scene when Richard is mentioned, and Elizabeth says, "Know ye not, I'm Richard II. This play has been performed above 40 times in the public playhouses." She knows how powerful it is. You mentioned a minute ago, Craig, the that fantastic scene in I suppose one could call it a rap bout, but and people will look at that and go, "That can't have happened." But actually, it kind of faithfully reproduces the clash between young Will and the established university writer Green, doesn't it? Tell us about that.
It does. Well, you know, Robert Green was a sort of leading member of the university wits, and he was an incredible character, actually. He wore this, it was described as a goose shit green doublet, terribly, horribly stained, and he was engaged a couple of times and sort of fled with a dowry, and he had an illegitimate son with a criminal called, I think, Moll Cutpurse was perhaps her name. And so he was this kind of incredible intellectual who lived like an absolute lowlife. And on his deathbed, he wrote this this diatribe, basically, called "You Can Give Me the Full Name, A Groat's Worth of Wit Got with a Million of Repentance," or something like that. Yeah. Basically, you know, "My life's been so terrible. I've done so many bad things, but I hate you all nonetheless." And one of the things he railed against was this upstart crow, beautified with our feathers, you know. And historians pretty much agree that it's probably Shakespeare, because he's talking about someone who didn't go to university, who's trying to be just like him and all his highly educated university wits who are, you know, who are writing these plays. So you can imagine that Green would have encountered Shakespeare. It was a fairly small world, the theatrical world. And so the rap battle is a dramatization of perhaps the first time Green encountered Will and called him out. And Will, of course, as the new kid on the block at first, is on his heels and doesn't know what's going on and thinks, "Oh my God, I can't best this guy." But I think with a character like Will, he knows he's smart. He knows he's good with words, and he's got ambition, and he has to know that he has this talent within him. Otherwise, he wouldn't take the chance to you know, leave his wife and three kids back in Stratford and go and try and make it on the London streets. And so, you know, he comes back and he starts slow and he builds and builds. And I wrote it, you know, very consciously, sort of a little bit like the scene from 8 Mile with Eminem, you know, meets Rocky, you know, and it's back and forth and back and forth. And then he starts and he gets on a roll, and eventually he slays Green. And that's the point where he's really cemented, I think, in both Richard Burbage and Alice's mind as something really special. And it's a moment of great, I guess, elation and joy for Will, but it leads into that next scene where they're kind of raging through the streets and he's yelling at the stars. It's something that Shaker and I talked about. It's sort of the unbottling of the genie or the genius, in a sense, within him, which he still can't control and doesn't really understand. And that's what plays out in that scene in the street that Shaker shot so beautifully.
It's a fantastic scene. I mean, it almost struck me that he knows he's got the talent, but England is a class-ridden society, isn't it? And he's coming from the countryside, and Green is accusing him of being a country bumpkin, isn't he? You know, provincial stage tricks and rustic. Mm. So the moment, and he knows he's from Warwickshire, he's not from the universities. Yeah. So the key moment is also giving him the sudden surge of confidence that he can cut it with the these people, isn't it?
I have to tell you, it was when I read the script and I came across the scene, and I just kind of said, how could I let anybody else direct this? And it was just such an amazing scene because, you know, scenes that actually talk about 10 things at the same time, it wasn't just the battle. It was also inherent in the scene was Shakespeare's discovery of himself. He discovers who he is. And if you read, you know, when you're looking at that, you realize that before that, he's unsure. He's tentative. He's hesitant about his own genius. And it is a moment, it is moments like these that put you under pressure, put you under panic. And in that panic, you suddenly realize that genius can come and take over. And then when we talked about this, and then that's why at the end of that scene, when they come outside, you realize that actually it could be madness too. You know, that enthusiasm, and in the end, it starts to lead with madness. So it is also an evaluation of what genius is. You don't know you have it, and suddenly you put into panic, and genius comes into you, and it gives you a kind of a drug. It's like a drug. It's an elation. And then you go crazy. And then you can see at the end that, hang on, is this him or is it madness? So there is a lot in that scene that you can just look at.
And it starts to kind of take him on, doesn't it, through the episodes. Yeah. I mean, you're watching him and he's taken over by it. You know, we'll get to it on a later podcast, but when his wife and family come to Stratford, you see that he's actually been taken over by this now, you know, not just by his love for Alice, but by the direction he's taking. Let me take that on, that idea, if I may, which is the third great kind of theme, which is about life itself. And what I love about the series is, because we all imagine Shakespeare as some balding middle-aged guy with a ruff, but this show is about youth, isn't it? And it's young people, and it's sexy and kind of dynamic and energized, and it's about youthfulness. And he's married. He got a much older girl pregnant when he was 18. He's got three kids. He's taken out of school early by his dad. He can't go to university. He can't get an apprenticeship. He's sort of stuffed in terms of what he's going to do with life. And we feel that from the moment that he starts, the moment that the film starts, that he's setting out to try and make it with the odds stacked against him, but he already wants to be a poet. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Or playwright. But I mean, of course, you know, poet was it was an interchangeable term back then. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely what his life would have been like at that point. All those things that you say are the bare historical bones of what we can divine about Shakespeare at that time, and the odds would have been stacked against him. You know, it was a very dangerous and almost mad decision to say, I'm going to run off to London and become a rock star. That's going to solve all our problems, darling. His wife's like, no, you're not. You're a freaking idiot. We've got three kids. We live in this tiny little house. We've got with your mad father. We've got no money. And you're going off to London to become a rock star. And by the way, where's London? That's Mars. But he does it. And, you know, throughout history, throughout life, throughout even our own lives, you know, sometimes we do things that seem crazy, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. And you know, most of the characters in history, like in this world, like Green, like many of them died young, and either violently, like Marlowe, or poverty or disease. And we've got a line in the show, you know, there's that famous line in popular culture that we have now: live fast, die young, leave a good looking corpse. And we've changed it a bit, and in the show it's live fast, die young, leave a pox ridden corpse. And because that's, you know, that was the feeling of just living for the moment, because you didn't know if you're going to be alive tomorrow. So yes, this decision, it's a ridiculous decision. It's a brave decision. You might say it's an irresponsible decision. But nonetheless, he makes it. And if he hadn't made that decision, we wouldn't be sitting here in this fabulous studio talking about William Shakespeare today.
It's great, isn't it, Shaker, how his life still seems to be open to every kind of interpretation to us today. We all impose our kind of fantasies on him, don't we?
I have to tell you that was the story of my life. I was an accountant, and I made a mad decision to become an actor. Didn't work. I became a filmmaker, coming from a middle-class family, and I came to London. I mean, I was telling Craig that scene that he wrote, you know, about everything that happens in London when Will first comes to London. I said that was my experience as a little middle-class boy. I came to London, and I saw the first place I went to, because I'd heard so much about it, was Carnaby Street.
just close by to us now, actually. I can see it just at the end of the...
And yeah, what did I see? I was mesmerized by the images.
Yeah.
Color and freedom.
Yeah.
Actually, what I saw was suddenly from all the middle-class structures and strictures that I had and the moralities that my head was... and all the guilt, suddenly was freed, because I came and I saw, lots of pretty girls, of course, but color, and I saw freedom. Mm. And so I went out to say, this is like a drug. Freedom is like a drug. To me, the coming to London that time was like a drug of freedom.
That's what Will says in the film, isn't it? Mm. When Marlowe says to him, what do you want?
Yeah. Freedom.
Freedom.
Above all, freedom.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And you know, freedom means lots of different things to different people. There's political freedom, there's religious freedom, there's artistic freedom, there's creative freedom. But I think there's also the freedom within yourself that Will is looking for most, which is probably freedom from this terrible obligation that he feels to a kind of abstract God that was instilled in him from an early age, you know, a punishing God that sends you to hell if you don't do the right thing, if you don't believe in the right things, you know, the kind of guilt I think that Hamlet experiences all the way through the play as represented by the ghost of his father, I think Will feels through kind of the feeling that he's not ever living up to being the person who can lay down his life for his religion in the way that he's you know, superstar, charismatic cousin, head of the underground Catholic movement, Robert Southwell can and did.
So episode 2, Cowards Die Many Times. Funnily enough, that's the line in the little collected Shakespeare that Nelson Mandela and his fellow prisoners had on Robben Island.
Yes.
That is the passage that Mandela ringed and has got his signature on it in, I think, 1977 or something like that. It's a powerful idea, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
The brave only die once.
Mm. Mm.
This is the episode where the form and pressure of the time, as Shakespeare would say, comes right in on the story of Will, isn't it?
Mm.
And this is where the Catholic-Protestant divide suddenly becomes very powerful, and Will, we realise, is caught up in
Yes. As we see with the death of Baxter, the playwright who was arrested in place of Will with a sleight of hand, if you'll pardon the terrible pun, by Marlowe, cutting his hand. And I guess in a sense this is where, for the first time, the life and death stakes of the world, the present world that Will's in, are really brought home to us, because there's, you know, there's this comic character, Baxter, and suddenly he turns up dead on stage. And it really sort of changes the temperature of the show and brings home to us as an audience and Will as a character and Alice just how dangerous this game is. And, of course, you know, our characters know that this is the world. And I think, you know, in all situations, it's of a world, it's nuanced. There can be a car crash. If you're in the car crash or someone you know is in the car crash, it's terrible. If you see the car crash, well, you're a bystander and it's kind of interesting and kind of terrible. And, of course, they know what a dangerous world it is, but now it's coming right into the theatre, literally. So we see Will dealing with the ramifications of this throughout the episode, and this dangerous dance between he and Marlowe really ramps up during this episode.
When you look at the dilemmas and the crises that are set up in this episode, Will comes from a Catholic family and still calls himself a Catholic, doesn't he? Mm-hmm. And yet his relationship with Southall, his cousin, who is the leader of the Catholic underground, starts, am I right, to feel as if Will, in his search for freedom, realizes that freedom may not lie that way, despite the justice of Southall's cause, that there's some kind of inflexibility in that view of the world. Do you think, Shaker?
I think that in the second episode is a lot about the fact that if you've suddenly emerged as a popular figure and you first plays a hit, that euphoria can't last because real life still catches up. And in the second episode, real life is catching him up and saying, well, you know what, I'm not going to let you go that easily. Freedom doesn't come. Freedom comes at a great price. And freedom means that you have to fight your own devils. And we often forget that. And that's the essence of the show as it carries on, but also it sets up here that freedom is also your devils, and your devils are together, and out of that will arise creativity. And so what I think Craig has very cleverly done is he's brought back all the demons that haunt him, you know, and he's brought back, and every time when I read it, I kept thinking, Hamlet, Hamlet, Hamlet. Maybe Craig has a Hamlet sitting in front, inside him somewhere, but it's his demons catching up. Because
Shakespeare had a Hamlet haunting him inside.
Exactly, So that was the demons inside him are the addictions of his past, the addictions of his childhood come back. And actually it's fascinating because ultimately when you're creative, you deal with your demons. You can't be creative with your demons. So they're coming back to haunt him almost as if to say, guys, you want to be really creative? Deal with us. Yeah. You want to really write something amazing, and that's what he did. Deal with us. Mm-hmm. We are there. That's part of you. It's inside you. You can't escape us. So the euphoria is not just freedom. Freedom comes after dealing with all this. Never comes, actually.
Yeah. And I suppose we watch him understand in the end that, a closed religious system like that leads to closing of minds in the end, whereas his art leads to an opening of minds.
Or questioning.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think William Shakespeare's great gift was his ability to see into the human condition, to see into the human soul, and to be able to
and his own, and
be able to represent it through character, through through drama. So I think if he is innately the quintessential humanist, then of course he's going to bump against dogma, and religion that is very, very strict. Formal religion like Puritanicalism or Catholicism, by its very nature, is inflexible because there are rules which cannot be transgressed against, and that is fundamentally anti-humanitarian because human beings are complex and they're contradictory and there's shades of grey. Hopefully, even more than 50, it's my theory. And what the show puts forward, that Will probably grew up as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, 8-year-old, thinking, yes, this fabulous cause. Because young boys always want a cause. Young men always want a cause. We see that today in our worlds, often with tragic consequences. You know, we feel good when we've got a cause, something to fight for. Think, yes, I'm going to lay down my life for the one true religion, just like my uncle did, just like my fabulous cousin Robert Southall would. You know, I will be Catholic, you know, unto death, like that little, the League of Catholics. That was their thing. You know, I will lay down my life for the one true religion. And then at a certain point, he goes, maybe not so much. Maybe there's more to life than that. Maybe there's things that I'm interested in that are more complex and deeper, and that is where his writing comes in, I think. And that brings him constantly into conflict with what's within his soul and his family and Robert Southwell, and that's a big part of the show.
Mm-hmm. One of the great characters in the series, not just this episode, but he comes out brilliantly in this episode, is Christopher Marlowe.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, Marlowe is one of those charismatic shooting stars, isn't he, in the Elizabethan age? And I love the way you portray him. He looks like a member of a kind of late 60s Californian rock band, doesn't he? And charismatic, with this very interesting spider and fly kind of relationship with Shakespeare, where there's almost a seductive charge between them, isn't it? Well, they kissed.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Marlowe was the rock star of his time in terms of the theatrical scene, and he died young and he died violently, and he was very famous. People would yell out lines of his plays at him as he walked down the streets, you know, "Holla, you pampered jades of Asia," and like, you know. And he was a spy, and he said outrageous things. You know, "He who loves not tobacco and boys' asses is a fool." And he talked about, you know, God and Jesus in very inflammatory terms. So, yes, I think a rock star who lives fast and dies young is just a particular type of character. And those particular types of characters we know have existed throughout history. We know that people don't change. That's why Shakespeare's plays are relevant, because the characters he wrote 400 years ago seem completely fresh and modern if they're presented in the right way without changing the words. So he's just a particular type of person.
To me, Marlowe and Shakespeare kind of mirror images of each other.
Mm.
It's when they look at each other, Shakespeare is naivety and innocence. Marlowe is loss of innocence. And in a way, that's what was so amazing. That's what, again, I come back to what genius can do. It can come to you and come to you like a breath of fresh air and take you up and give you fame. Then when you get a little arrogant and you take it for granted, it can leave you. And it leaves you desperate. That's why you go to drugs. That's why. And you gradually look for... It's like extreme sport. That's what genius is like. You go for extreme sport, and now suddenly you can't go down that hill on your snowboard anymore. And so you look for other things. And so Marlowe then, he started to look to put himself in danger, that he could get killed, somehow to get back that high. So when Shakespeare and Marlowe are looking at each other, they're looking at the beginning and the end and the possible end. And that to me was fascinating when I read everything that Craig had written about Marlowe. They were mirror images of each other that way.
And Marlowe does push things to extremes, doesn't he? I mean, you know, people watching the show may go, "Come off it, Marlowe wasn't a secret agent, was he?" But he was.
He was. I mean, he almost had a death wish. Why else would a writer become a secret agent except to put himself in death's way? Constant death's way to feel it. It's like, all right, how do I feel it again?
It's easy to forget, isn't it? I mean, Shakespeare carried a sword. Ben Jonson killed a man in a duel. Marlowe killed somebody. Marlowe was killed. They live close to death.
Constantly. As do modern rock stars often.
Yeah, in a different way. In a different way. Not through violence,
But through violence inflicted upon the self, too.
And at that point, Marlowe's had a string of massive hits, hasn't he?
Yeah. It's hard for us to imagine just what a superstar he was, because theater was like a mixture between rock and roll and television. Everyone went to see the theater, and it was this massive explosion of popular entertainment. Popular entertainment, as we know it today, was being born right then and there in London in the theaters. A huge proportion of the population went to see theatre. They spoke about it. They argued about it. They supported the playwrights that they loved. They derided the ones that they hated.
And women too in the audience.
And women too in the audience, which was remarkable. It was the most democratic place in that society. And I think democracy was born right then and there on the stages of those theatres, because you had the highest of the high in the land and the lowest of the low all in the one public space, which is pretty incredible when you think about it. It's like you're there with the Secretary of State and, you know, someone, you know, who's little better than a beggar who's paid a penny, and they're all hearing the same ideas, often quite inflammatory ideas, spoken about and acted out in front of you all at the same time, cheering or booing or so, and everyone spoke about it. And Christopher Marlowe was right at the pinnacle of that pyramid at that time.
I mean, big faith in the intelligence of the audience. I mean, as popular entertainment goes, the best of these plays are really demanding, aren't they, Shaker?
It completely reminds me of the first day, first show of a big star Bollywood movie. You have the balcony audience that is trying not to scream and shout. You have the people in the boxes that are trying to show everybody that we're actually not part of your fan, you know, this great mass movement. And then you have what they call the masses. And that's what I've never understood. Because if you ask anybody, saying, they say, oh, they're all the masses loved it. I've never met a person who said, I'm part of the masses. They're always this other person. There's this kind of an intellectual snobbery about it. But if you go to a Bollywood big star, first night, you go down, you are the noise from the what they call the stalls. You can't hear the film. When there's a song, they get up and dance. And they don't like it. They'll tear up the seats. They like it. They throw coins at the screen. You can't hear anything. You can't. The dialogues are not. I mean, I'll show you videos. You cannot hear the dialogue. Those theaters at that time were like a modern-day Bollywood. So I know it well. I really know it well.
Just the last question on this episode, and that's just the nature of the game. As a professional writer, I love it. Is it Burbage at one point who goes, getting new plays is a bloody nightmare, or something?
Yeah.
You know, we forget, don't we, that the turnover of an industry like that. I think at one point Burbage says, you know, or somebody tells him, you know, at most you get two performances of the same show in a week. Sometimes you might have seven different shows in a week. That doesn't work anymore. That works. We don't want that. Revenge tragedy's back. It's like kind of Tarantino, isn't it? We want more of those. Can you do a prequel? Can you do a sequel? Write this. Write that. It's a really high-pressure collaborative industry, isn't it?
Well, I think in that respect, it really was like television. There was this voracious appetite for content. And in some ways, I think that's why Will, the TV show, makes such sense as a long-form TV show, because theatre really was immediate, as television is, and it was groundbreaking and revolutionary, as good television is at the moment. And it, you know, we really wanted to smash, didn't we, Shaker, this idea of, oh, you know, it was the olden times, so everything was really, really slow and people wandered around with lots of free time in their hands. No, of course they didn't. That's not the world we created.
You know what? I'm reminded of something Bob Dylan said recently. He said, my best lyrics were written with the speed that I could write and my pen could move and spill ink on the paper. That's how Shakespeare wrote. I mean, that was the point. You had 10 minutes to write a new scene, and the actors had to go and perform it. You had one day to write a whole play, and the parts had to be given to perform it. So there was this incredible velocity at which creativity happened. And, you know, when you think about it, you think that he wrote those wonderful lines and he may have rewritten them. We don't know. But when he wrote them, he had to write them at a speed that was incredible because the play was going to be performed the same day or the next day. So was Romeo and Juliet, was it written after 6 months or 1 year of contemplation and doubt? Or was it written on the spur of the moment? And it kept changing.
And revised and revised and revised. Yeah, several different versions. Yeah. Such a hit. Let's just make that a bit better. You know, they change it. They work. It's a collegiate form of entertainment, isn't it? And I have to say, guys, that all power to you with London Calling by the Clash beginning the whole series and the end of this episode, Will Kemp and the Sex Pistols. Who could have ever dreamed that?
Listen, if that's great, it's his call. If somebody throws bricks at it, I didn't do that. That was Craig's idea.
Great. Thanks to Craig Pearce, creator and executive producer of Will, and to Shaker Kapoor, director and executive producer.
Join the three of us next Tuesday for an all-new episode of TNT's Will Podcast as we take a closer look at Episode 3, The Two Gentlemen. Be sure to subscribe to TNT's Will Podcast in the Apple Podcasts app, and please leave a rating and a review while you're there. And remember, Will is all new Mondays at 9 on TNT. I'm Michael Wood. Thanks for listening.